Most of us don't have to imagine the day-to-day difficulty of living on the streets. The concerns range from the big, I don't know where I'm sleeping tonight, to the smaller, like my cell phone is not up to date. That second example can actually be more serious than you might think. Recent research out of the Bay Area shows that problems keeping up to date on electronics in a changing world have an effect on a homeless person, and generally not a good effect. Let's explore the research and its implications with Dr. Maria Raven, who's both MD and Master of Public Health, Associate Professor of Emergency Medicine at the University of California, San Francisco. Dr. Raven, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
So I understand we're looking at just a portion of data brought in through the Hope Home study. Can you round out what that is for us?
Sure. The Hope Home study is overseen by my colleague Margot Kuchel, who is an internist at UCSF. It's an NIH-funded study that's charting the lives of 350 homeless people. Most of them happen to be single Black men who are age 50 and older in Oakland, California. And the study is generating a lot of findings about many aspects of the lives of older individuals experiencing homelessness, which many people might know is actually the largest growing segment of single adults who are experiencing homelessness. It's people over age 50.
That was probably one of the more surprising things up front before we can get into some of the finer points of the research here is the fact that you just have so many people who are of advanced age living on the streets.
Yeah, and it's also that individuals that are over age 50 who are experiencing homelessness suffer from conditions earlier in their lives that people who aren't homeless don't experience until they're older, including, you know, certain kinds of chronic disease and cognitive decline and other problems.
So things, if we were living in shelter, that we wouldn't expect how much earlier are they experiencing these things from living on the streets?
As early as 15 years earlier.
Okay, so happening a lot sooner in life. That is not a good combination, homeless and older.
So
you mentioned that the National Institutes of Health fund the study. Is this unlike any previous study? I'm curious to know if anything quite like it has been done before.
To my knowledge, nothing like this has been done before. There actually hasn't been a lot of research on older individuals experiencing homelessness, which is one reason why Dr. Kuchel's Hope Home study is generating all kinds of interesting data, like the data that we're going to be talking about today. There have been a number of different studies that have come out of her research and that continue to.
Well, it sounds like a rich vein of stuff. I mean, you've got lots of information potentially in front of you over time. But let's talk about this particular part of it, the communications and technology portion of it. What did you want to do with this part of the research? What more did you want to find out?
Well, we were really interested in the idea that cell phones, mobile phones, the internet, all of these things are things that most of us take for granted as having access to. And I, as an emergency physician, care for homeless individuals on every single shift that I work. And I always think it's so ironic that people that are experiencing homelessness who have so many difficulties just going about their day, you know, they may not have a car, they don't have a roof over their head. They also, you know, really have difficulty with many other things, like just getting to an appointment on time or getting to an appointment at all, and suffering through weather and all these kinds of things. And some of these conveniences that people that are housed have, like phones and technology, are often things that we don't necessarily see individuals experiencing homelessness have access to. So I thought it was kind of ironic that this very simple and expensive tools probably weren't being optimized among individuals experiencing homelessness. So we were really interested in kind of exploring, you know, well, how are they using these tools?
Was there any data already in existence? Had anybody else looked at the sorts of things that you were looking at here?
They had, but not in an older homeless population. So to our knowledge, this is one of the first studies looking at technology use in a population of older homeless adults. You know, there are obviously studies looking at technology use that Pew does in housed individuals, and there's been some research among younger individuals experiencing homelessness, but not among older individuals.
Okay, here again, the reset, the reframing. We're talking about older adults here on the streets, single older adults. We're talking to Dr. Maria Raven at the University of California, San Francisco, who's been doing research into homeless people and their use of mobile phones and the internet and technology generally. You can join the conversation on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. So the method of data acquisition here is that every 6 months you interview the men in the study. Is that right?
Yes, and it's men and women, but it is more men than women, and it's a pretty intense method of sampling that Dr. Gushel came up with. So they use what's called population-based sampling to really try to reflect what the homeless population is like in Oakland, California. And that means that they recruit individuals from homeless encampments, shelters, a recycling center, low-cost meal programs, and all these sorts of places. And then once they identify the initial cohort of 350 people, yes, they interview them every 6 months. And so if you can imagine, it takes a lot of kind of building trust and work by her study team to do all of this follow-up. And they actually have remarkable follow-up rates.
How long ago did it start?
They recruited the initial sample of 350 people between July 2013 and June 2014.
Okay, so quite a long time ago then. We've got several years of data in there. Any issues with finding the people at the interview intervals?
Well, they've done an incredible job. Their follow-up rate is over 80%. It's in the high 80s. And that's pretty amazing for this type of study, which is called a cohort study, when you follow a group of people over time and observe things about them. But especially for a population of individuals who are experiencing homelessness that are maybe transient and you don't always know where to find them, the staff, and it's really a testament to the staff and I think the patients that are, or the individuals that are involved in the study, that they have such high follow-up rates.
Do the members of the cohort get anything in return for their participation?
They do. They have incentives that they receive at follow-up interviews. So participants get gift certificates for $25 for the initial screening and baseline interviews, and then $20 at each 6 month follow-up visit. And then they also get a $5 gift certificate at monthly check-ins between scheduled visits. And so I think the monthly check-ins and the $5 gift certificates are kind of a way for the study team to keep closer track of individuals so that at those six-month intervals when they want to collect that crucial data, they have a better sense of where people are.
Okay, but they are coming in monthly, you're saying, just to make sure that you can maintain contact with them?
They're trying to do that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, but the actual data collection is a six-month interval?
Exactly.
Okay. A fairly grim number, I noticed right off the top. It looks like several people had died by the time of the first six-month check-in.
That's right. And we're finding that more people than they realized have died before the initial check-in. And that's something that we're finding, and I'm doing some other studies that involve individuals experiencing homelessness who are older and have a lot of chronic illness and substance use and mental health diagnoses, and I've been shocked at the mortality rate. It's much higher than in similarly aged individuals, even with similar medical conditions, who are housed.
That's saying something, because you're an emergency medical physician and you're shocked by this anyway.
That's right.
Wow.
That's right. I'm saddened by it. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So to the point of the electronics portion of the study then, Dr. Raven, roughly 3/4 of the people in the study have phones, but what kinds of phones are we talking about here?
Yeah, well, that was what we found interesting. Not so surprising, but 3/4 of people owned or had access to a phone. 2/3 of those people had regular mobile phones or feature phones, there are not lots of different names for them, rather than the smartphones that we're used to, which, you know, obviously they can't access the internet via phones that are just regular kind of flip phones. And then we also found that only about 6% of the people with phones actually had annual service contracts. So when we go into Verizon or wherever we go to sign up for our phones, I think it's safe to say that most of us sign up for annual phone contracts. And we did not find that with this population.
Okay, so 6% then with the annual service contracts. So if you don't have the annual service contracts, which is the 94% or the 94% of the people who do have phones, what happens to them? What happens to their service?
Well, what happens is they will either have their service cut off and their number will change. So one of the benefits of having an annual service contract is you keep and continue to keep your stable phone number. And when you're getting phones in other ways, you know, maybe buying a phone that's that's prepaid with a certain number of minutes on it, often called burner phones that you can then throw away, or when people just don't pay their bill and their service gets cut off, then that means their phone number may change. And that's problematic for a number of reasons.
We're talking to Dr. Maria Raven at the University of California, San Francisco, where she's an associate professor of emergency medicine, also master of public health, in addition to being an MD, and part of a study looking at homeless people and technology use and how their lives can be just a little bit worse, even with the wrong kind of technology in their hands or the older kind of technology in their hands. You can join the conversation with questions and comments on the phone at 800-838-3760. On the email, listen to me, jx@jeffnet.org. So I want to make it clear that this is not like, oh, poor, you know, this is so sad that these people don't have phones. But the fact is that we've, as you point out in the study, the world has come to require people to have electronics more and more.
Yes. And again, getting back to the sort of ironic part, we almost make things more difficult for the most vulnerable people, in the U.S. and probably in other parts of the world too, by not allowing them to have access. I mean, these are people that are really at the bottom of the digital divide, and they're the people that would really benefit from having consistent, stable phone numbers. For a variety of reasons, so.
What kinds of thing? I mean, if your phone number is changing all the time, it's not like people can get a hold of you easily, which can be an issue if you're trying to get to medical appointments and things like that.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So one of the things we were interested is in this idea of bidirectional communication. So, you know, you think about you calling your doctor and they're not there and leaving a message or leaving a message with the clerk and then the doctor is able to call you back. And that's often not the case with individuals who don't have access to phones with reliable phone numbers. Similarly, we did find that people, you know, despite being at the bottom of the digital divide and having less than ideal phones and service, it was really interesting to find that the people with phones, which were the majority of people, used those phones for really practical, useful things, like trying to get a hold of family, trying to get a hold of medical providers, reaching out for employment and housing opportunities. And so people want, I think it shows people want to use phones for these valuable things, but we just have to optimize their ability to do so by giving them consistent numbers.
It has been pointed out that in the age of cell phones, it is something of a benefit now that your phone comes with you so that, you know, if you're looking for work and yet you don't have a place to live, at least your employer can call you. But if your phone number is changing because you're changing contracts or you're getting a new burner phone each month, that sort of negates all that.
That's exactly right. And another interesting thing that we heard about, although not as much as I would have thought, but I definitely, it came up in the study and it comes up with the patients I see a lot, is some people actually don't necessarily want smartphones because they are worried that they might get stolen or that they might create some kind of, an episode where they're endangered because someone tries to steal their phone. And so to some extent, you know, I think some people feel safer with burner phones because they are not as tempting for other individuals to steal. So that's also kind of interesting.
Right, another concern. Yeah, you want to make sure you don't have anything too valuable out there. I mean, yeah, I see the point there. The interesting, too, to think that we're talking, again, a cohort that's generally, they're all 50 plus, is that right?
Yeah, all of them are 50 plus, yep.
And some of them have never been on the internet.
Some of them have never been on the internet. We found that 55% So just over half had used the internet at some point, and about 40% had been online in the previous month. And many of them used the internet at public locations like the library, which is a great place for individuals experiencing homelessness to go ahead and get online, check email, all that. And about a third of people actually did have an email account.
Did you find, Dr. Raven, that there's a fairly close tracking with the people who had the older, the feature phones versus the smartphones? Can you directly trace outcomes, health, housing, anything like that, if they're lower in technology, are they lower in these services too?
Oh, that's a really interesting question. So we can't really say anything about cause and effect, but we did look at factors that were associated with mobile phone access. So not smartphones versus basic phones, but just having a phone in general. And we did find that individuals who were housed at the time of their follow-up interview, so when we interviewed them for this study, which was 6 months after enrolling in the cohort study, they had almost a 4 times higher odds of currently owning a mobile phone compared to people that hadn't been housed. And so I think, again, doesn't show causality. It's just an association. But I think that could either mean that a stable living situation can enable more consistent mobile phone ownership and charging, or that having access to that phone may have helped participants regain housing by being able to call different services and kind of, as you were saying, have a phone with them where they could communicate with people at crucial times.
And again, not causality for sure, but correlation certainly.
Exactly.
So, given the fact that again, so many more things are turning technological, you have to go certain places to get information. This would seem to work against people who don't have access to more modern devices on a regular basis. I mean, not at their hands like a lot of people do. So, what happens, for example, with medical offices trying to set up appointments and things like that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that as healthcare moves towards the use of things like online portals to communicate with patients and make appointments and order tests and fill prescriptions, it is going to, I think, increase the divide between individuals who don't have access or reliable access to that technology and people that do. And I don't think it would be very hard or expensive to provide homeless individuals with that type of technology. Some of the things that we think about, for example, in our emergency department is telehealth, right? So right now, there's an emerging field of telehealth, and there's not always enough access, for example, to substance use services and mental health services. And those are some things that increasingly can be done via telehealth. But if you're experiencing homelessness and ironically really need those kinds of services more than maybe someone else, you may not have access to them, but you could do something simple like set up an iPad in the emergency department that would enable someone there to have that internet access while they're there, or set up similar connections in places apart from just libraries, like homeless service agencies or other places where people experiencing homelessness go. So I think there are lots of ways to improve the situation, but right now, there's a lot of work that needs to be done to get there.
But I see your point, though, that instead of just having to go to the library or a couple of centrally located places, a lot of places that would potentially have devices that wouldn't be that expensive and a lot of people could use them and stay in touch.
Right. Exactly.
So when you're working as a provider then, not as a patient then, I mean, and granted you work in emergency medicine, I get it, so it's not necessarily a lot of scheduled appointments, but if a provider is trying to make sure that somebody shows up for their regular follow-up care, et cetera, and you can't get a hold of them because they don't have a device, what do you do on your end?
Yeah, it's really hard. Sometimes people are lost to follow-up. Sometimes what internists like Margot will do is make lots of interval appointments for patients where they can come and check in and they kind of have these standing appointments so that they just say, okay, every week you're going to come in on this day at this time. So it's set up in advance. But of course, that means that someone has to have the wherewithal to actually get to that appointment on time. And it can be a really difficult thing depending on multiple factors like public transportation, with the weather, as you know. And so people will go to great lengths. I think physicians go to great lengths to try to accommodate these sorts of barriers to care. But, the emergency department is open 24/7. And I think that individuals experiencing homelessness need options apart from the emergency department that have more of a drop-in kind of quality, where you can kind of just get what you need when you need it without having to necessarily make an appointment.
So, Dr. Raven, do you track the numbers of the people that you see? I mean, I'm just curious to know what emergency versus non-emergency cases that might have been handled otherwise, but that are coming to the emergency room because they don't have access to a regular doctor, or they don't have contact with a regular doctor.
Yeah, it's hard to say exactly, but there is that perception. I would say a lot of individuals that we see that are experiencing homelessness actually are pretty ill. So many people have illnesses that, yes, if caught earlier by, for example, a primary care provider or treated in a way that makes more sense. For example, like a skin infection on your leg requires regular antibiotics and elevating your legs, and that's not something you can do if you're homeless. So a very common thing we see is individuals that come in with a serious cellulitis because they haven't been able to adequately treat it. So we see all sorts of things, but I think our general feeling is that once you get to the emergency department, in most cases it's usually a rational decision because you couldn't get care anywhere else.
All right. We've been talking generally about the technological implications of being on the streets with older technology, but the Hope Home study overall, you brought the people in first in July of 2013. You said a cohort of 350 homeless people in Oakland, all 50 plus. Have there been things that just blew your mind as you began to take in information from the study?
I knew that the rate of annual phone contracts would be low, but I didn't realize it would be 6%. But some of the other things were a little bit more positive. I thought it was amazing that people were so resourceful and used their phones to do so many things that were really practical and useful, despite having a suboptimal form of communication. So things like I mentioned before, being in touch with family and friends, being in touch with healthcare providers.
You know, some really fascinating stuff in here and implications for us as a society to see what we can do about it. Maria Raven is the lead author of Mobile Phone, Computer, and Internet Use Among Older Homeless Adults, Results from the Hope Home Cohort Study. She is an associate professor of emergency medicine at the University of California, San Francisco. Thank you so much for joining us today on The Exchange.